Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by none other than D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show, they have a very, very special guest on. It is none other than best-selling author, and her books have, of course, created the show Bones, and that is Kathy Reichs is going to be talking, and this show is called Bones Tell the Tale, an interview with forensic anthropologist and best-selling author Kathy Reichs. Of course, all of our shows are sponsored by KensingtonBooks.com. Go check them out to see what's going on with their new releases. Also, DarkRenaissanceBooks.com. Go see what they got going on for this holiday season. Maybe you find some gift ideas. And Kevin Hurley's book, Cut and Cover, is out. And make sure you go check out SilkReel.com. for more information on what they have going on. So it's going to be a great show. So you can sit back, relax, and enjoy, because here we go with Crime and Science Radio.
Well, welcome, everyone, to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. This is called Bones Tell the Tale. It's an interview with forensic anthropologist and best-selling author Kathy Reichs. Kathy really doesn't need any introduction, but I'm going to give you one anyway. As you know, her entire bio will be on the website, and you can do that. But she's a native of Chicago, and she received her PhD at Northwestern there. She's also served on the board of directors and is vice president of both the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and the American Board of Forensic Anthropology. And she currently is a member of the National Police Services Advisory Council in Canada, and a professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. She is a forensic anthropologist, so she writes about what she knows. And as everyone knows, she's famous for the Temperance Brennan novels that have been wildly successful on the bestseller list time and time again. And, of course, the spinoff of that was the hit show on Fox TV, Bones, and it was based on that. And in addition, she has a new series, a young adult series called Virals, that she writes with her great niece, Tori, that is stars Temperance's great niece, Tori Brennan. So, Kathy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Good to have you here. Before we get started, first of all, I want to congratulate you on receiving the 2015 Silver Bullet Award from International Thriller Writers. For those that don't know, this is given for outstanding achievement in the pursuit of literacy and the love of reading. Can you tell us kind of what your work is about that led to you receiving this honor?
Well, I think it was because of some of the involvement I've had as a forensic anthropologist. I worked at Ground Zero after the Twin Tower disaster, helping recover victims of that. I've gone to Guatemala to exhume a mass grave, victims of the Civil War down there. And I guess just for some of the charities that I support, Helping a Hero and every animal charity on the planet, I think, among others. So I think that was basically what it was for.
Well, you've had an amazing career. Let's start with one of the first ones. What attracted you to anthropology in general? And then forensic anthropology in particular?
Well, it was kind of a ragged path. I didn't really know what to major in as an undergrad, and I think I had three prior majors. And then I took a course in physical anthropology, and I just really loved it. So I got my undergraduate degree in it and went straight to grad school and got my grad degrees in it. But I intended to study ancient skeletons to do prehistoric materials. And I was actually doing that very happily, doing bioarchaeology, when police started bringing me cases. And when I started doing the medical examiner, coroner, law enforcement work, for me, that was just, I love archaeology, it's fascinating, but if you're wrong, you're going to get into, or right, I suppose, long debates in the literature with your colleagues, and you're not going to impact anyone's life. Whereas when you identify a missing family member or you testify in court, you are, and you have to be right. So I really liked the relevance of it, and I retrained and sat for my board certification, and I've been doing the forensic end of it ever since.
And do you work full-time as a forensic anthropologist or only on certain cases?
Yeah, I work on a per-case basis. Very few of us work full-time. There are some out at the Central ID Lab out in Hawaii working for the military, and some state medical examiner offices have full-time forensic anthropologists. But a lot of us work at universities or museums and consult on the side. So that's what I have been doing for my career.
Well, let's look at this in general. What exactly does a forensic anthropologist do, and what role do they play in the world of death investigation?
Well, we work very closely. I primarily work for large government labs, like the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner here in North Carolina, and for the equivalent body, it's a combined medical, legal, and crime lab for the province of Quebec. And we were brought in, we work very closely with forensic pathologists and forensic dentists in particular, although not exclusively. And we're brought in cases where human remains are found that cannot be identified, or that cause or manner of death or time of death can't be established because the remains are compromised. They're burned, mutilated, mummified, decomposed, or maybe just skeletal. So we help address those questions. Who is it and what happened to this person and how long have they been dead?
Yeah, you mentioned this, but besides that, most people think that bone identifiers, people coming in looking at skeletal remains, are basically trying to do ID. But you also try to weigh in on what the cause and the matter of death is. How does the forensic anthropologist get into that, and what do you look for that helps you find a certain cause or manner of death?
Well, we look for anything in the bones, and there's not always an answer. But if there are bullet entrance or exits, we can look at, you know, where it went in, where it came out. We can use that, how many bullets were there. We can, you know, if you know the trajectory, you know where the victim was, where the shooter was. Those are the kinds of questions we might answer. Stab wounds, we might be asked to determine what kind of sharp instrument was used, if it was an axe or a knife, or if it was a knife, what kind of knife, that sort of thing. Any blunt trauma or strangulation, anything that's going to impact the bones. Now, if you're, you know, gut shot or stabbed in the belly, you know, may not touch a bone, and we may not be able, or poisoning. You know, there's some cases when we can't give an answer. But we do it when a normal autopsy can't be done because the body is just in bad shape.
But you mentioned poisons. Are there any poisons that can be found within the bones?
It would have to be some of the heavy metals. It would have to be something that was ingested over a long period of time that could have worked its way, you know, that metabolically into the bones or into the hair.
So like chronic lead or mercury poisoning, that kind of thing.
Yeah, arsenic, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, you, as we mentioned earlier, that you work with the National Police Services Advisory Council in Canada, and you also are a professor in anthropology at North Carolina. I'm sure that gives you a lot of free time. What exactly do you do at both of these jobs, at each of these jobs, I should say?
Well, I'm currently on the longest-running sabbatical ever. it's a great job. Technically, it's not a sabbatical anymore, but I've been on leave for many years, since the book became as popular, well, from the beginning, actually. So I'm not actively teaching, but I'm still, I think my status is adjunct professor.
Okay.
At the university. And then the Police Advisory Council, we just meet periodically to advise on the police services in Canada, which includes the National Forensics Lab and the National Police Academy and the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So we're kind of like a brain trust to give advice to the National Police Services.
So you also train FBI agents in locating remains, which is kind of a different part of of forensic anthropology. Can you give us just a, realize that's a full course, can you give us a thumbnail of what you teach them?
Well, yeah, it's a team effort. And there's a forensic, there's an entomologist, there's a pathologist, I'm trying to think who else makes up the team, and we come together and just give them the proper protocol for when human remains are found. You don't just start picking them up and throwing them into a cardboard box, or you don't just start going in with shovels. You want to use not full archaeological techniques, like you'd record every single tiny item as you would in an archaeological dig, but basically that kind of approach where you do map it out and you do grid your area before you just go in and start grabbing things. So we would teach the special agents who come in from all over the country to Quantico, to the FBI Academy there, and we would just teach them those techniques, how to work with a cadaver dog and, you know, how to excavate a grave or how to collect surface remains.
So you're also helping them learn how to find clandestine graves?
Yeah, we do a little of that. Yes, we do. What to look for, what kind of clues, differences in the vegetation, differences in the slump on the ground, that kind of thing. What are the clues that might tell you where a body could be buried?
Well, one of the things you mentioned earlier that you worked at Ground Zero after 9/11, and you, what was that experience like, and what was your involvement there?
Yeah, that was tough. I went in with the second wave. It's through DMORT I went, which is the Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Teams. Those are federal, it's a network of federal teams. There are 9 districts that pretty much coincide with the FEMA districts. And they're teams that are activated in situations of mass fatalities, mass human fatalities, at the request of locals. So I'm in District 9, which is in the southeast. Is that my district, or is that the number of states in it? Anyway, we're the southeast, the district there. But after 9/11, it was so massive that they just were taking people from all over the country, to DMORT members, to deploy them to New York. And no one could get there initially. So I was, you couldn't rent a car, you couldn't fly, obviously. Everybody knows that. So I went in with the second wave, I believe, and we just spent a lot of time. I was partly at the Twin Tower site, but largely out at Staten Island at the landfill where everything was being brought, and we would just spend 13-hour shifts going through debris and just trying to find anything that might be human remains. There were, and that was our main job, was to, nobody was being identified on site. It was mainly just, is this human remains? Because most of them were so fragmentary, it was DNA identification. So we would determine if it was human or not. There was a lot of animal bones. There were restaurants and catering services and whatnot in the Twin Towers. So just determining it, if it's human, then we would give it a medical examiner number and bag it, and then the ME van would come every day and pick it up.
But that never crossed my mind about restaurants and stuff, and that there would be other animal tissues.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that is, I think it's also interesting because I do think a lot of people think there were identifications made out there on Staten Island, but you really were just doing that first really important
triage
thing, right?
Yeah. There may have been a couple. I vaguely remember there may have been some bodies that were largely intact because they were underneath fire trucks or something. Mm-hmm. But most everything was, because at that point there had been the initial attack, and then the buildings collapsed, and then there was fire, and then there was water, and then it was loaded into trucks and transported, you know, and then we would go across these great big, out at Staten Island, it would go across these great big conveyor belts that would kind of shake the big pieces free from the little pieces. So it had been through a lot by the time we found it. It was, yeah, tough work.
Wow.
But, you know, I'm very grateful to be able to, because everybody wanted to do something. Everybody wanted
sure.
to chip in and donate blood or money or sneakers or whatever you could. And we were actually able to, you know, get in and physically dig with our hands and try to, you know, contribute.
I bet it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was psychologically and physically very demanding. But everybody was fragile. Is the point.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, do you, I know one of the things forensic anthropologists do is work in mass fatality situations. Like this is one of the areas where I think sometimes people think you guys are only dealing with bones, but you're also sometimes in this kind of situation, like when you mentioned being part of the DMORT situation where there's a mass fatality and there's a need for identification. So when you're in those mass fatality situations, what are some of the steps that you take to identify remains?
Well, I think every disaster is different. So every disaster has to be arranged in a different way, and it depends on what kind of remains you're going to be looking at. We don't necessarily just get bone. If it's an airline disaster, you may have, you know, fully fleshed body parts that you're dealing with. So each one is different. Also, if it's something like a plane crash, you know exactly who's on the plane. So you're not working with an open population. You're trying to match up remains to a specific list of individuals. That's not always the case. You don't always know who it is that's going to be coming through your station.
Well, one of the things you also did is you worked on identifying remains from World War II and Korea and Vietnam. How did it come about your involvement in that, and what role did you play? What was that like, and what kinds of things did you get involved in making?
Yeah, that was through, it's now called JPAC, J-P-A-C. It's the Joint POW-MIA County Command. The United States government has a commitment to its military personnel that if we send you overseas, if we send you offshore, we will find you and we will bring you back. So JPEC exists for that purpose. It's located at Hickam Air Force Base out in Honolulu, although they've just undergone a bit of a restructuring. But so their teams and the remains that come in to the Central ID Lab are largely from Southeast Asia, but also from Korea, and also from occasionally World War II or even World War I. So every time remains come in, there's a staff of full-time, I think they employ like over 30, maybe even close to 40 full-time anthropologists out there. They do all the actual identification and recovery, the recovery teams that are on the ground regularly in Southeast Asia. But anytime there's a positive ID, it has to be approved at multiple levels. And one of those levels is an external civilian scientist has to look over the entire dossier and approve the identification. So that's what I did. And that would involve getting case files sent to me. Some of these were like 6 feet tall. They were suspect. Old flight plans from World War II and, you know, photographs of the old military, what do you call it, tools and, you know, personal identity things that were found. And anyway, you go through and then go through that and either approve it or not approve it. And then twice a year go to Honolulu, which is a real tough sell in the winter to your
department. Exactly.
And then just consult with them because they feel a little isolated over there, and just, you know, oversee the lab and keep the staff up to date on developments in the field.
Good stuff. Well, thinking back over your career, are there cases that really stand out, that really made a stamp on you, imprinted you with like, wow, this is pretty cool, or this is odd, or this is whatever? Are there any cases that just stick with you?
Well, there's one kind of interesting case that, and each of my books is based not necessarily in a case, but on something I've done, like spider bones. Is based on my work with JPAC and the lab out in Hawaii. And Great Secrets is based on the human rights exhuming the mass grave down in Guatemala. So it's always based on something that I've done. And so my work has fed into my books, my creating fiction. But there's one case that it went in the other direction. When my 10th book, which is called Bones to Ashes, came out, it was partly based on this little child skeleton that I have had and still have in my lab for over 20 years. It was found around 1990, somewhere roughly in there. So this book is set in Acadia, among the Acadian culture in New Brunswick, in eastern Canada. So when it came out, I was there to do a promotional tour, French language promotional tour. And I did an interview, and I mentioned this little skeleton and how it had inspired the story and that it was still unidentified. And the police got a call from a young man who said, I think I know why those bones ended up in the plastic bag over the side of the highway with where they were found. He said, my friend and I were 12 years old, and we were bicycling past the graveyard in that town and saw some bones fly out. They were digging a new grave, and we thought it would be cool to collect them and scare the little kids at the elementary school. Well, they decided that was a bad idea, and instead they dumped the bones, these little bones, over the side of the highway. So as a result of going on book tour and writing that book, we finally found out why that little child ended up in the plastic bag over the side of the highway. We still didn't know who it was. You can't tell the gender of a six-year-old from the skeleton. So someone else read that story, which appeared in the paper, and they came forward and they said, we think that's our little brother. He was killed in 1963 by a car, and he was buried in that cemetery. So as a result of the book, not only, we think we're going to get this little guy identified. We now not only know why he ended up in that plastic sack, we now probably are going to know who he is and get him back to his family after all these decades. So
wow.
Hey, this is pretty cool. We're waiting for the mitochondrial DNA results.
Cool. But, you know, one other thing that you did, you also went on the USO tours, which has got to be just fantastic. How did that come about, and what did you do there? Who did you go with? And I know that they don't, you don't even know where you're going half the time until the last minute. What was that all about?
That was organized through the Thriller Writers, International Thriller Writers, in conjunction with the USO. And there were five of us that went, Andrew Peterson, Sandra Brown, Clive Cussler, Mark Bowden, and myself. And we went to Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan. And we just, the intent was to meet with the troops and to just thank them for their service over there. And we went to thank them, and they spent all of their time thanking us for coming. So it was really quite a moving experience. And then I used that flying there and being there in Bones of the Lost, I think, which is maybe two or three books back. But it was quite an – we would go to forward operating bases. We would fly on Black Hawk helicopters. And it's quite an experience to be sitting next to Mark Bowden, who, of course, wrote Black Hawk Down, you know. So we're sitting there wearing our 8 pounds of body armor and helmets and everything, and I just, as long as Mark was calm, I was calm, so that worked for me. We had him sign the inside of the helicopter.
If he panics, you freak out, exactly. Well, we're going to take a brief break here, and then we'll be back with more. Well, welcome back, everyone. We're having a wonderful chat here with Kathy Reichs. This is Bones Tell the Tale, and Kathy is a forensic anthropologist and best-selling author. And so welcome back to the show, and we want to talk a little bit about your writing now.
Okay.
And I'm excited to get to this part of the program, too. You had and continue to have an amazing career in forensic anthropology. But somewhere along the line, you turned to writing fiction and have been very successful at that, to say the least. What led you to do that?
Well, I'm a full professor at the university, so I was free to do pretty much anything I wanted to do. And I thought it would be fun to try fiction. Nobody ever heard of forensic anthropology back then, back in the mid-90s. So I thought it might bring my science to a broader audience. And I had just worked on a serial murder case involving some very interesting elements of dismemberment, in which I was asked to look at the could I look at the cut marks in the bones and determine what kind of implement was used for the dismemberment and anything else. So it turned out to be some very interesting testimony at trial about how this dismemberment took place. So I had the basis for an idea for a story, and I had the freedom to do something new. So that all came together around 1994, I think. I started the first book, and that came to be Deja Dead. I turned it in 96, and it came out in 97.
Well, so tell us about your writing process. Do you have a set time of day to write? Do you outline? Do you not outline?
Oh, that's a complicated question. I write every single day I'm home, that I'm not on the road or I'm not working on a case or testifying or something like that. I don't have the luxury of being a full-time writer, so any day I have a free day, I write. I try to get at it by, I'm not real big on firing out at dawn, but I try to get at it by 8 o'clock in the morning anyway, and then I stay with it pretty much. I'll break for lunch and then get back to it and pretty much stay with it till 5 o'clock, something like that. I do outlining for the young adult series. We do quite a detailed outline for the Bible books. That's possibly because I have a co-author on that. I write those with my son, Brendan Rice. So we do a chapter by chapter, quite lengthy outline before we begin writing the story. Not so much with the Tempest Brennan books. I pick the setting. Where is it going to be? Is it going to be in the Carolinas? Is it going to be in Quebec? Is it going to be, you know, over in Afghanistan? I pick the crime. I know what the crime is going to be and what the science is going to be to drive the story. I don't always use just bones. I always have some blood spatter pattern analysis or mitochondrial DNA from cat hair or something. You know, what is the science in this book? And then, so I know the storyline. I know, of course, my characters because I have my core cast of players. And then I maybe will outline the first 5 or 6 chapters. And after that, it's pretty much a free flow. I know how it's going to end, obviously. And then I just go at it. Now, writing screenplays for the show, that's a little different process because you do it collectively, at least initially. You go to the writer's room and you do what's called breaking the story. And you do that with the other writers and you put your outline on at the beginning of the week. The walls of our writer's room are covered with erasable boards and they're terrifyingly empty at the beginning of the week. And by the end of the week, you've all, you know, hammered out together the outline, your A story, your B story, and your C story of what your episode is going to be. So that's a different process yet again.
And is it hard at all for you creatively to switch between those processes, or do you have to kind of mentally go into a different gear? Or?
Well, it's hard. It's hard to work with a co-writer because, you know, other people have opinions. They may not speak the same as my opinions, and I always find it astounding. So Brendan and I have written 5 young adult books together, so, and then he's dumped me. He just signed his own multi-book contract, so he's off on a different series. But our editorial meetings could sometimes be a little fiery, but in general it was a very good experience working with him. And the same thing when you write for television. I was shocked, the first screenplay that I wrote for the show, when they changed things. Because when I send in my book manuscript, my editors, you know, pretty much say that's splendid and here's some, you know, suggestions. And it'll maybe take me, I don't know, it'll maybe take me maybe 10 days to do them at the most. It's very, very minimal. Whereas writing for television, people actually change parts of your, and it's for many, many different reasons, for budgetary reasons or because a particular actor isn't available or because a particular location that we would need to shoot is unavailable. So there are lots of reasons that the changes get made. But to me, that was kind of a surprise the first time.
Hmm. And as you've told us, you're also working from, especially for the books, and maybe also for the other areas, but for incorporating things that you've worked on, you know, maybe not real cases per se, but inspiring, those are what are inspiring, I'm assuming.
I take the nugget of the idea, just like it's the core particle that starts the whole, okay, we've got this body that's discovered and there's a very peculiar manner of dismemberment that's evident. Well, what is this and what is that and what is that or what is that? So I just start with something like that and then spin it off into fiction. I never use actual cases, you know, real names, or I change all of that, the actual places and names and dates for, you know, both legal and ethical reasons.
Sure. And as Ann Rule told me once, if you want to get sued, write true crime. Whatever you write, somebody's not happy. The crime is that way. What you mentioned, co-writers and all that, I mean, you obviously, you know, the Bone series everybody's familiar with, but you said your son Brendan that you wrote the Viral series with him. And so tell us a little bit about what that series is and how it was to work with your son that way.
Yeah, it was his idea. He's a lawyer and hated being a lawyer. He practiced law for, I think, a total of 3 long years, and he really wanted out. So he suggested doing a young adult series because we had a lot of kids that would come to my events, or like kids are watching Bones, or I would have parents say, you know, is it okay if my daughter reads your Temperance Brennan books? And
right.
I go, well, yeah, how old is she? And they say, well, she's 7. I go, no, she's not. So we proposed the idea for a series. The main theme of it is that it's Temperance Brennan's 14-year-old great-niece, Tori Brennan, and her 3 best friends who are boys. And they're not the cool kids at school. And they love science. They're kind of geeks, and they love science. And they use forensic science at kind of a middle school to high school level to solve cold cases and mysteries. So we proposed that, and the publisher said, yeah, that's great. We love it. Now just throw in a vampire. Or a zombie. We said, no. So we started thinking, because grounded fantasy is very big in the young adult and middle grade, what they're reading right now. So about that time, we adopted a puppy, and the puppy got sick. The puppy had parvovirus. So we started madly searching parvovirus, researching it, and we learned that canine parvovirus cannot jump to humans. We thought, well, wait a minute. What if it could? So what happens to Tori and her friends is they rescue this dog, which has been infected during illegal experimentation with parvovirus, a weaponized form of parvovirus in which the DNA was altered. So it can now jump to humans. So the kids get sick. They recover. The dog recovers too. But when they recover, they notice they're changed, that they can hear way beyond what the human ear can hear. They can see much better than humans. They have all these wolf-like qualities. They can smell if people are lying or if people are afraid of them. So we combined that idea of these super sensory capabilities, using that and then using their love of science to solve cold cases. So that's the main dual premise in the series.
That's a lot to juggle.
Yeah.
Wow.
That infamous what if question. That's how they all started. Well, obviously the TV series Bones is based on your work. How did the creation of that come about, and what was your role in that, and what do you do in the series right now?
Well, I'm a producer. My main role is to work with the writers, although when I get out to be on set as often as I can. And Emily always has lots of questions, not so much now, but in the early years, lots of questions, because she really, really wanted to get it right, and, you know, how do you glue a skull back together, and that kind of thing. I also do, as I said, write periodic episodes, at least one per season, I write one, and then you have to be, and I co-write those with my daughter, Carrie. Carrie Rice, who is also an author. She's also an attorney who doesn't practice law. I don't know where I went wrong. I went to law school. So anyway, she's got three novels of her own out there. And so we write them together. We co-write them together. So it's fun. We go together and we break the story with the other writers. And then for your own episode that you've written, they like to have you on set. So she and I are out there for the shooting of each episode as well. How did it all come about? I do not remember exactly the sequence, but I was approached several times with offers, both for television and feature film, and none of them was the right offer. But then when Barry Josephson and Hart Hansen, who came to be our executive producers, and Hart was our showrunner, approached me, we sat down and we all seemed to be on the same page. We wanted a character-based show. We didn't just want another police procedural. We wanted characters that people would be invested in and be engaged by and come to care about. We wanted to keep the science honest. That was my concern, and they took that seriously. We didn't want to make some of the errors that are made on some of the other shows or take some of the liberties. And we both wanted to put humor into the show. Which I do in the books as well. So we just seem to be on the same page with it, and I said, okay, let's do it, and let's option the character. And that was now, amazingly, 11 years ago.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, we've come back over for our 11th season, so I guess we're doing something right. I also just learned last time I was out there that we are in every single foreign territory in the world.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Well, I mean, part of that popularity, obviously, is Jennifer Brennan, who's just a fantastic character. So how did you create her? I mean, did you look in the mirror?
how much
of her is you, and how much of you is her, and how did you come up with this wonderful character?
Yeah, we have to talk about TV Tempe and book Tempe, because they are a bit different. Tempest Brennan in the books is based on myself. She's a little bit younger than I am. But professionally, she does exactly what I do. She commutes, I guess you'd say, between Charlotte, North Carolina, and Montreal. I remember when the first book came out, a critic said, this is ridiculous. Nobody would ever work in these two places. I do. So that's what she does. I'm told she has my sense of humor. A lot of my friends, when they're reading the books, they say, oh, yeah, I could just hear you saying, you know, and then I'll quote something that Tempe said. But for her personal life, that's all her own. She's, you know, doesn't drink. I never go into it in detail in the books. We know she's had a colorful period in her past with alcohol. But now she's a non-drinker, and her marriage has disintegrated, and she has only one child, a daughter. So her personal life is her own. She's dating a guy named Andrew Ryan. So, yeah.
So there's Temperance in the books, and there's Temperance in the television series. How are they different, and why is there a difference between those two?
Yeah, Tempe on television is younger. It's Fox. The market is just a younger demographic. I knew that from the get-go. As long as they didn't make her a 22-year-old psychic, you know.
Always a danger.
Yeah, exactly. So she's in her more moving towards her 40s. How old is Emily? She's 36, 37, somewhere in there, 38 maybe. She's not as sophisticated or as polished as the Temperance Brennan in the books. She knows little about pop culture. And she's very formal in her thinking, very rigid in many ways, and not able to emote very well. However, I think if you binge-watched Bones and watched Emily from season 1 to season 10 playing this character, you'd be amazed at how this character has evolved. And that's partly the writers, and that's also partly Emily as well. So I think that answered your question, didn't it?
Yeah. So now, before writing fiction, your writing is scientific writing. Those are two very different kinds of writing. What surprised you most about your roles as a novelist and a television producer in terms of that difference?
As opposed to writing scientific articles or textbooks, more lucrative. A lot more people read them than read my textbooks, although every now and then one of my textbooks will still come through a signing line. It astounds me why anyone would buy it or read it. Because scientific writing doesn't have to be entertaining, whereas when you're writing fiction, it has to be entertaining. I think people read my books because they like to learn something. I write murder mysteries, but they're science-driven rather than intuitive or good old-fashioned cop legwork. So I try to put a different aspect of science in each of the books. But people don't, they're not looking to read a textbook. So you have to keep the science brief, and you have to keep it entertaining. You can't just do it as a narrative. You have to find new and creative ways to introduce the information. And you have to keep it pretty much jargon-free. You can't rely on all the special terminology that we use among ourselves as specialists. So I think that's one of the big differences between writing textbooks and writing fiction. Also, you can make stuff up. You're not allowed to do that when you're writing scientific articles. Well, you're not supposed to, anyway.
Yeah, but people do, unfortunately. So series characters, there's always that issue, you know, they talk about evolution of characters, but when you're doing a whole series, you know, you can evolve them right into another species if you're not careful. So how do you handle the difficulties of writing a series character and keeping that series going for as long as you have?
Yeah, some things get harder, some get easier. One of the things you have to address is, are you going to age your character? You know, I just released book 18, so Tempe should be 18 years older than she was in the first book. Well, she's not, so I'm just taking that literary license. But you also have to keep your, as far as age goes, you also have to keep your character evolving and changing, I think, and your relationship between your characters evolving and changing. So that's a challenge. And also you have to... I totally lost track of what I was... One of the difficult things is that for any given book, when a reader picks it up, that may be their first Temperance-Brennan book. So you've got to introduce the main premise and your characters. But that book may be somebody else's 18th book. So you can't do it in the same way every time, I don't think. So you have to come up with new and creative ways to introduce your core cast of characters and your premise with every single book, and that gets harder and harder. I've had her sitting bored in a faculty meeting writing her autobiography. I've had her being, you know, cross-examined on the witness stand. You know, you don't want to just give it as narrative. You want to have it in a creative way, but get the information out there.
But you kind of touched on this earlier, but for the writers, and we do have a cadre of writers that listen to the show all the time, what advice, bullet points, can you give them about when they're writing scientifically based thrillers, you know, whether they're techno thrillers or medical thrillers or whatever, of keeping that line between the science and the fiction acceptable, I guess is the right word.
Yeah, plausible, acceptable. I'm a stickler for getting it right, get it correct. And if you're going to write about, you know, a forensic entomology, contact one. Talk to a forensic entomologist and get your facts right, or get a book on it at least, Entomology for Dummies or something. Don't just throw it out there and make it up. And keep it, well, I think I gave a little bullet list. Keep it brief, keep it entertaining, keep it jargon-free. Or if you use any jargon, be sure to explain it in an original way. Don't just put it in narrative again. I keep using that over and over. But so I think, to me, you can't just make it up to be convenient for your story. You've got to make the science be right if you're going to put the science in there.
Well, tell us about your latest book.
Ah, the latest book is currently sitting on the New York Times list. It came out a couple weeks ago. It's called Speaking in Bones. Thanks, yeah.
The title what?
Speaking in Bones.
Right.
And I think it debuted it on the hardback number 5 or something. I forget. It is set in North Carolina. When we were researching, in the third book in the viral series is called Code. And that book features geocaching, which is a game people play online, in which you hide a geocache, and then you go put the GPS coordinates at the geocaching site. Other people look them up, and then they go out and they try to find these little things that have been hidden. So while we're researching that, I came across another online pursuit called web sleuthing. And web sleuths are amateur detectives that go online, and they go to sites that list unidentified human remains. And then they go to sites that list missing persons, and they try to match up the unidentified human remains with persons reported missing. I'm greatly oversimplifying here, but that's what they try to do. They try to solve cold cases and put names to nameless dead. So I thought, well, that's pretty cool. So I wanted to incorporate that into the story. North Carolina, in the western part of the state, we have the Blue Ridge Smoky Mountains. So up there, there's a phenomenon known as the Brown Mountain Lights, and this is a phenomenon of these strange lights that appear over the mountain, and nobody's been able to explain them. The Geological Survey went out and studied them back in the 20s. They didn't really explain what causes them. There are old Cherokee legends about them. So I thought, okay, huh, that's pretty cool. So what if body parts turned up at overlooks that are oriented towards this weird psychic phenomenon? We also have some unusual religious groups up in the mountains in the more rural areas, including the Holiness Movement, for example, where they handle snakes and every now and then.
One of Doug's favorites.
One of my favorite subjects.
Every now and then we lose one because I guess they have substandard handling skills or whatever. Anyway, so what happens at the beginning of the story is a web sleuth comes to Tempe here in Charlotte at the Emmy office and says, I think you have the unidentified remains of a woman here in your lab, and I know who it is. I know who this person is, and she went missing up in Avery County, North Carolina, 3 years earlier. So that leads into this whole, Tempe reluctantly looks into it, and yeah, she does have these remains, and she looks into it and looks like, yeah, this ID could be valid. So that takes her up into the mountains and into many strange adventures.
So what's next? What are you working on now? The writers aren't allowed to have time off.
Exactly. I am working on an off-series book. My next book is not going to be a Temperance Brennan book.
Oh.
Yeah. So I don't know if I should tell you any more about that, give you any spoilers. It's going to be...
No tease.
I respect, though, your desire to... I think that the thing that happens with us when we sometimes talk too much about things in progress, and then you're like, wait a minute, I changed my mind.
Yeah, exactly.
It's in progress.
There is a link to the Temperance Brennan books. This character sort of derives from the second book, Death du Jour, which had to do with cults and religious. That's funny. But this one's more... Death du Jour had to do with cults rather than religious movements. So there's a link from there.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, this has been fantastic, and thank you so much for being on the show. We just had a great time here. A lot of good information.
Well, it was good talking with you, and we'll have to do it again.
Well, we will. And as all of our listeners know, we have links on the various websites, the crimeandscienceradio.com, my website, Jan's, John's at Blog Talk Radio or Suspense Radio, and it connects to where you can find more about Kathy, more about forensic anthropology, find her books, et cetera, et cetera. So until next time, Kathy, once again, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kathy.